Each year, it is my privilege to produce for you more than 200 Cato Daily podcasts featuring Cato scholars, outside experts, journalists, lawmakers, and others with interesting things to say. And at Cato, we accept no government money. We are entirely funded by private citizens and organizations. That means both Cato and the Cato Daily podcast are completely dependent on your support. To keep the Cato Daily podcast strong and growing, we've launched a new podcast sponsor program for this holiday season. Any and all donations to support the podcast are most appreciated, but at the $1,000 level of support, you'll become a Cato patron sponsor, which means you'll receive all the benefits of patron sponsorship. Additionally, unless you object, I'll personally thank you on the podcast. Cato is a 501c3 charitable organization, which means that your gift is tax deductible to the fullest extent allowed by law. To learn more, visit cato.org/podcast sponsor. That's cato.org/podcast sponsor. And as always, thank you for listening. This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, December 1st, 2017. I'm Caleb Brown. Creating a more robust response to attempts by foreign governments to influence voters and destabilize American institutions using social media, well, that largely requires individuals to smarten up and quit falling for it. It's no shortcut, but many of the other options on the table smack of censorship. Cato Institute Senior Fellow Fleming Rose comments.
There is something that Cato's foreign policy scholars repeat quite often when it comes to the issue of terrorism specifically. They warn against trying to make terrorists seem like this phantom specter that can pop up at any moment and are deserving of some sort of special treatment with regard to United States institutions, creating special courts, sending them to special jails. And in other words, the idea that because they're engaged in a specific type of motivation, that their destruction is deserving of special treatment. And it seems like there's a parallel with respect to the interference of Russia in the U.S. election. To call it interference is one thing, but it was an attempt to unduly influence voters, at the very least, using social media, tools that have been around for not that long, but tools that seem fairly innocuous at first. And do you think that this kind of interference is deserving of some sort of special treatment by our institutions?
Well, I think there are two issues here, and I buy into your analogy in the sense that I believe, as somebody who has, you know, I lived in Russia for 12 years, I was a correspondent there for many years, I still go there every now and then, and I'm very critical of the Putin regime, and it's an authoritarian regime, and it's, you know, modernization have been on hold more or less since 2012 when Putin returned to the presidency. But it's a question of proportions. And in that sense, I think when you talk to people, you know, to pro-democracy liberal people in Moscow and in Russia, they will say to you, you know, you are doing exactly what the Kremlin wants, because you are creating an image of Mr. Putin and the Kremlin as some kind of master geopolitical genius who, with the help of hackers and bots political ads on Facebook and Twitter, are able to almost, you know, put the most powerful country on its knees. But that's not the case, they say. I mean, the Kremlin is not that kind of organized political machine. It's divided. And there are many problems they're not able to solve on the domestic scene. So why are you creating this Superman image of Mr. Putin? And in that sense, there is an analogy with what you said, I think, about the terrorist. The other question is the way Russia or Kremlin-affiliated institutions in Russia have been meddling in the U.S. election. And even though we haven't seen, I mean, we've seen these ads, but as far as I understand, those ads were bought for $100,000 out of a total budget for the political circle in the U.S. in 2016. I think it amounted to $1.4 billion. $100,000 is not that much in this context. So the question is, you know, how influential? I mean, how much influence did the Russians in fact have? If they, I mean, I think it's fair to say that there was meddling, but the question is, you know, how much of a difference did it make? And I think here also the U.S. media tend to exaggerate because it's all about Trump. It's not about Russia. And it's very difficult for a lot of American liberals to accept that Mr. Trump is a product of American life. So they want to turn him into a creation of Russia.
Even if the, let's say, purchasing ads or having various trolls and bots on social media outlets, even if it was effective and we could draw a straight line between those, that type of advertising and that type of boosting certain messages and not others, if we could draw a straight line between that and the election result, it seems that we would still be taking the wrong, and our reaction was the same. It seems that that's just following the wrong, going along the wrong path.
Yes,
to deal with it.
I think the way to deal with it is to educate ourselves about how to how not to be vulnerable to emotional and cognitive manipulation. And that's a question of the education system in the U.S. It's also, I mean, what the Russians did were they were exploiting existing narratives, and they were exploiting this tribalization that is going on in American political life, and that has nothing to do with Russia in and by itself. It's a product of American culture, American political life, and you're also right, I think, in the sense, you know, there is this old notion, whataboutism, that every time you criticize Russia for something, then you will find a similar feature in the U.S., even though there is no moral equivalence. And I'm not playing that game, but I think it's fair to say the United States have meddled and interfered in a lot of elections around the world for, you know, the past many, many decades. They may have done it in a more open way, but usually they take sides and they provide money through government-affiliated or government-supported NGOs to support the good guys. So there is a little bit of a hypocrisy in the sense that, you know, if you ask the Russians, they will say, why are you so upset? We are just doing what you have been doing for several decades. Again, without making a moral equivalence, because I think the United States, when the United States do these things, they support generally good guys and they do it in a more open way maybe, but it's still a kind of interference and meddling seen from the point of view of the country in which the United States is meddling.
And you say that the response to either ban ads or Google recently announced that they would be de-ranking some websites, which is to say push the results from certain websites down in their algorithm, and they're free to do that to the extent they're not being coerced to do it by our government.
It's about Russia Today, RT, and I think that is a perfect example of what we're talking about. I mean, RT, Russia Today, is a Russian government English language TV station that can be watched, you know, all over the world in hotels and things like that. And in the American intelligence report on Russian interference, I think it was released in January 2017. I think it's 9 pages out of 21 that is devoted to RT. But where and they talk about how influential this propaganda organ is. But if you pin down the figures, then it turns out that very few people, in fact, watch RT. I think Nielsen's ratings, that they did a list of the 94 most popular news shows on U.S. television in 2016, and RT was not among them. It means that they have a share around 0.1%. And then U.S. intelligence services say, well, but they are very visible on YouTube. They have a million views per day. But then when you go in and look at the videos RT has on YouTube, they are all not produced by RT. The vast majority are not produced by RT. And they are, you know, it's videos that they buy when you have a disaster somewhere. Sensational events that looks good on television, but they have nothing to do with politics. And they only had one political video in the top 15 on YouTube, and that was Mr. Putin singing Blueberry Hill at a party in the Kremlin.
So the response that you offer is educate ourselves, make ourselves less susceptible to these messages of the moment that are designed essentially to inflame our passions against or for this or that, but that's not a that's not particularly tangible. And I think what Americans are looking for is something that is, I guess, a shortcut back to the good old days, however defined.
Yeah, but they're never going to come back. We live in a time of technological disruption, and the digital technology in many ways is very disruptive, but it's not going to go away. So, but we are illiterate in many ways when it comes to our ability to cope with that technology. You can do some very simple things when it comes to the distribution or dissemination of fake news. You can learn how to find the source of the information you're looking at. You know, what is the website? Who is writing? Where does it originate? Who is behind this information? Are there links to sources in what you are reading, and so on and so forth? Which is the basic of the fundamentals of the ability to of critical thinking, and we also have to learn more about our emotional and cognitive biases, and we have to learn in school how to overcome them, or learn how we easily get subjected to these kinds of biases.
What are some of the policy responses that you've seen to this spending and advertising by Russia on social media? What are some of the proposals you've seen that are particularly troubling?
In the West or in
The United States?
In the United States? Well, in the United States, it's more talk. I'm more concerned about proposals in the European Union. Germany has already passed a law criminalizing dissemination of so-called fake news, false information on social media, and social media are obliged to take down illegal material, that it is called, within 24 hours if it's very serious, and at some point they risk to be fined up to 50 million euros if they do not comply. I think this intimidates the whole tech the whole digital sector because you don't want to get into that situation. Whether you in the end will not get a fine or not, you will try to lower the bar, and it's better to take things off, even though you may believe they are legal, but you're not sure not to get into trouble. Because Germany is the most powerful country in Europe, they are also putting pressure on the European Union to take steps to that effect. And I think that is a real risk to freedom of expression online in Germany and Europe. And another thing is, in fact, in the German law is extraterritorial, which means that they can criminalize information that is not published in Germany if it's accessible by Germans.
Fleming Rose is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and the 2016 recipient of the Milton Friedman Prize for Advancing Liberty. This holiday season, support the Cato podcast and the broad mission of the Cato Institute by visiting cato.org/podcast sponsor. Learn more of the benefits of sponsorship. That's cato.org/podcast sponsor.